Go ahead and hit record. I don't know if this thing's working. Well, anyway, if you can get that. Don't know your phone. Other thing is just that we know we produce a lot of written content. We don't expect everyone here to be up on all of it. Part of the reason we have these events is so people can engage with our work in a more, you know, in a personal way, in a more informal way. So don't be afraid to ask questions, even if the questions are basic. This is, you know, to us an alternate way of engaging with our work. It's not supposed to be kind of a, you read everything, now what questions do you have? So, and that's why I'm going to give kind of a summary of everything we're doing. So, with that all said, the first thing that I'm going to talk about is our top charities, GiveWell top charities, and I'm going to start with the Against Malaria Foundation. So, GiveWell, you know, tries to find proven, cost-effective, scalable charities. We try to find the best we can, the best options for an individual donor to do as much good as possible with each dollar they give. And currently, as of, you know, December last year, and still true now, our number one is the Against Malaria Foundation. They distribute insecticide-treated bed nets that people can use to kill mosquitoes, block mosquitoes, avoid getting malaria. These bed nets are associated with a large body of impressive evidence that demonstrates that they save lives and reduce malaria very cost-effectively. So it's like $5 a net. Net lasts a couple years, covers a couple people oftentimes, and you know, overall we estimate that it's in the $2,000 to $3,000, maybe $3,500 range per life saved. And that estimate changes a lot because we try to adjust for all sorts of things, which I'll be getting into. So in the past, we've recommended the Against Malaria Foundation a lot of the time, multiple years. There was one point at which, a couple years ago, we suspended our recommendation because we felt that they were not moving money out the door fast enough that we were excited to see people give there more. And in other words, they had been sitting on a large pile of reserves for a year or two. And you know what the AMF has to do is they have to get the money and then go negotiate with, you know, African governments, with other funders, to put together a deal to have a distribution in a country to cover a, you know, a high risk of malaria zone. And so if they, you know, they need to make deals that meet their desires in terms of the cost per net, in terms of proof that the nets were delivered, which is something that we think they stand out on, in terms of follow-up data to see if people continue to use the bed nets as intended, if the nets stay in good shape, and they need to get all those terms agreed to. And so there was a time at which they kind of weren't finalizing those deals fast enough, and they had been sitting on a bunch of money for a while. Recently, that has become a lot less of a concern for us. And you know, a general theme of tonight and of GiveWell is that we do try to discuss our top charities in just very frank, balanced, you know, neutral terms. So I will tell you what I think is good, what I think is bad, what we're happy about, what we're disappointed about. That's going to be a different tone, I think, from what you'll normally hear from people involved in the nonprofit world. So it's, you know, this is, we try to, our whole game here is sort of that we're not fundraisers, we're not marketers, we're just saying how it is. And we, when we estimate the cost per life saved, that number is higher than you might see from, you know, a thing you get in the mail with a child's face on it, because it's not a fundraising pitch. It's our best estimate, and it's us trying to account for all the complications that we can come up with. So AMF, you know, we have seen a lot of improvement on its ability to put together deals, and in particular, late last year when we recommended them, as a result of our recommendation, a lot of money went to AMF. And a lot of it was from Good Ventures, which is a major donor that works closely with us. A lot of it was from individuals. It was about $40 million total. This year, AMF has already signed two deals totaling about $37 million for bed net distribution in countries it has not previously worked in. It's in discussions about other distributions. It currently holds still about $23 million on hand, but it's very likely to have to slow down its work and put together fewer deals if it doesn't get a lot more money pretty soon. So we think it probably is going to have to slow down, and it would need another $11 million soon to move as quickly as it could. And we have no reason to think that's going to happen. So definitely the, you know, and it could use perhaps up to another $18 million during this calendar year. So the picture with AMF has changed in some sense in a positive direction, in that sense that they are putting together more distributions. And in particular, one of the things that we used to be concerned about, that they prefer to pay only for the bed nets themselves and are reluctant to pay for distribution costs and monitoring costs, they, you know, that has changed a bit. And so they have been paying for some non-net costs in putting together those deals. We've been very happy to see that. On the flip side, we have been, you know, a little bit disappointed by monitoring reports that have come in from their work in a very difficult country, DRC. We, you know, the reports came a little later than we hoped, and the results were not, you know, can't talk about them fully yet, but I think overall, we, in terms of the quality of the data, in terms of the timeliness of the data, we've been, I would say, moderately disappointed. It's not a game changer. It's not going to change our recommendation of AMF, but that is another factor, that is another update, and that's important because it's our top charity. Another thing to know about AMF is that the Global Fund, which is kind of the biggest international multilateral funder, is holding a conference in September where governments and other big funders are going to be asked to make three-year pledges. And our early read is that there may be a lot more money for bed nets from other sources in 2018 than there is in 2017. So that has some interesting implications. That could mean that, you know, donations to AMF that are done soon are more valuable than donations that are done at the end of this calendar year. Most people give at the end of the calendar year, but if you're someone who has some flexibility, that might be something to consider because there may be less of a global bed net gap, less of a global need in 2018 than in 2017, and AMF tends to work, you know, pretty far in advance. So that is something to know. It also does, you know, potentially affect cost effectiveness because you give out these bed nets and you hope they last 2 to 3 years. And so if there's going to be another distribution anyway in a couple of years, that could potentially sort of, you know, reduce the bang for the buck by some relatively small factor. So that's a thing to know. And then we have done some other research on other things related to bed nets because the stakes have gotten pretty high with AMF, sending tens of millions of dollars there on our recommendation. So we want to kind of nail down everything we can. We did a series of little case studies on what happens when AMF is working on a distribution and they decide not to fund it. What happens? Does someone else just come in and fund it, or do things get delayed? And the usual story was that things got delayed on average more than a year. And so we kind of walked out of that case study situation feeling that, you know, not a hugely changed view and largely feeling kind of reassured that that AMF really is distributing bed nets that probably weren't going to get distributed otherwise. And then another thing we did is we have been very aggressively keeping up with the state of knowledge about insecticide resistance. So over time, through a variety of mechanisms, mosquitoes may get better at avoiding the insecticide. And it not being affected by the bed nets. And those changes could be genetic, they could be behavioral, but they could, you know, worsen the effectiveness of bed nets. Unfortunately, it is really hard to get data that is really useful about how bad resistance is and about how it's affecting the effectiveness of bed nets. You can go to an area, collect mosquitoes, expose them to insecticide, and notice they're taking longer to die than they used to, but you don't really know how that's affecting the impact of distributing bed nets in real life. And so, you know, there are a couple of high quality studies going on that are going to be more informative than anything else that has happened before. But for now, our picture, having caught up on the insecticide resistance literature and on the little case studies, is, you know, in the same range of where we were in terms of the cost per life saved and in terms of how good we feel about AMF. So bottom line, we are less concerned about AMF's ability to move money out the door. We've had a monitoring, you know, maybe a little bit less excited about the monitoring, though that's always an ongoing thing. And we're probably not going to make a big push for this, but I think it is worth considering that there's an argument that if you want to give to AMF, it's better to do it soon than to wait for December this time around. So that is AMF. Quick update on our other top charities. There hasn't been a ton that has changed, but SCI, the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, they put together government programs that deworm children, basically give them pills that kill common parasites. And, you know, an issue we've always had with SCI is we've always felt it runs a good program. Deworming is a good program. It's very cheap. It's pretty simple. We think it generally works. It is a pretty good value for money. It's roughly comparable to bed nets, though in a very different way because it's kind of, for us with deworming, there's a good chance that deworming actually doesn't have a noticeable positive impact. And there's also a good chance that it has kind of an amazing impact per dollar. And so it's accounting for those possibilities that we think on balance it's about as good as bed nets.
But SCI as an organization, we've always had trouble communicating with them, and we've never really felt that we understand them as well as we understand other charities, that we understand their financials in particular has been a real struggle to just understand where their money's going and where it's coming from and what the situation is. They're at a university, and so they have kind of these commingled financials that are not easy to make sense of, and that we have not, you know, had a great time trying to do that. This year, we said we really needed to see improvement on that, and we did see improvement. We've gotten basic financial info that, you know, we've had for other charities for a while, but we're really glad to have it for SCI. We also saw a couple of errors in the info that didn't make us feel, you know, perfect about the situation, but we do think SCI is, you know, improving on that front. We think it's still pretty far behind our other top charities in terms of the how we feel about the organization, and it's our clarity of understanding what they do and their ability to communicate effectively with us. But probably they're going to end up in a similar place on our top charities list overall. And then GiveDirectly gives out direct cash transfers to very low-income households in Kenya and other countries. And they are kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, where we do think our best guess is that bed nets and deworming are a better value for money. They help more people for less money than just giving out cash. But we think GiveDirectly is really topping the list, and by a substantial margin, in terms of being an impressive organization that has shown an ability to scale, that has been creative, that has really come a long way in a short time. One of the cool things about GiveDirectly is I believe all or nearly all the money that they're disbursing in cash transfers is also part of experiments. So they're always trying like two different approaches, randomizing them, comparing them, always trying to generate knowledge as well as, you know, generating positive things by giving money to very low-income people. This year, an example of a couple of new projects they have, they're working on a $25 million initiative to test a basic income guarantee. So this would be, instead of giving people a lump sum, of a one-time lump sum, which is intended to encourage investment, they would give people a regular income and test it and run kind of a big study on it and see how that, you know, what they can learn about how people respond to that. And that's obviously a hot topic in a lot of different parts of the world. And it is a different topic in America than in the developing world, but it still, I think, will be very interesting. And then they're also working on a partnership with a really major funder to do a series of studies comparing normal sort of standard aid interventions to cash transfers. So in other words, if we're doing a agricultural training program where we try to help farmers do better, you know, get better yields from their land, is that better than just giving them the money that it would have cost to run this program? I think that's probably a question people should have been asking for a long time. But now there's going to be a series of studies asking that very directly in a randomized setting, and we're pretty excited about that. GiveDirectly did run into a snag in one of the areas they're working, Homa Bay, Kenya. It looks like local leaders may have been advising people not to accept the transfers. They ended up moving to another part of the county, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, happens in these situations. They're working a lot of different places, and they've really scaled up quite impressively. But the bottom line is we feel similarly about GiveDirectly. They're impressive. They have kind of, you know, extensive room for more funding, and that is where we're at. And then the final update is on Deworm the World, which is another organization that does deworming, treating children for parasitic infections. And they are working on expanding to other countries, but they are not funding constrained right now. So that is not, you know, a major target for donations at this time. So that's kind of the top charity status. Overall, we've still got Against Malaria Foundation in the number one spot, all things considered. People might want to consider moving their donations up. That said, we are not recommending to Good Ventures, the major donor we work with, we're not recommending that they close the gap. And the reason we're not doing that is because Good Ventures made a major grant to AMF last year, and that grant was intended to kind of be a large commitment, but also be the end of the commitment for that year, because we don't want to get into a situation where Good Ventures always fills 100% of every funding need they see, and therefore that creates a situation where other people have no incentive to give and do their part. And so that's a longer topic. We had a very extensive discussion about it, I think probably at the last event, and also there's been extensive discussion on our blog. But that said, I'm happy to answer questions about it. I've just been talking for a while. So that is the top charities update, and now I'm going to take questions for a bit before talking about some of the things that we're doing to find more top charities in the future. So, yeah.
One thing I just wondered is, for like SCI and AMF, like, Are there, if those two organizations just didn't exist, are there similar organizations that are like a close second in the same field, like in the BenNet field and in the...
Sure. I'm going to be repeating questions. That's for the recording. So if SCI and AMF didn't exist, would there be a natural next place to turn for bed nets and deworming? Well, in the case of SCI, there's Deworm the World. So there's, you know, there's two recommended charities that both do deworming. One of them is not funding constrained. And we don't have anywhere to go after SCI. I mean, we're actively working on it. We're looking at a couple of contenders. But I would say there's no obvious place where you can write a check and expect more people to get dewormed beyond those two. AMF, I would also say no. I would say that there are other organizations that will, you know, that have a mission of delivering bed nets. But if you want any kind of reporting, you know, confirmation that the bed nets got delivered, checkups on whether people are using the bed nets, checking up on malaria case rates where the bed nets were distributed, we've gotten just zero engagement from anyone else on the idea of kind of collecting and sharing that data. So, you know, you could, there's a group called Nothing But Nets. They work with the UN Foundation. They, you know, by mission, they do bed net distribution. You could write them a check. You could hope for the best. But that is, you know, that is all I can say about Nothing But Nets because they've declined to participate in our process.
Other people can go if...
Sure, you should go ahead if you're looking for clarification. Yeah.
What kind of reporting does AMF do on bed nets and along those lines? Is there reason to think that other organizations that deliver bed nets have, like, that reporting would come back worse than AMF does?
Sure. So this, you know, what reporting does AMF do, and does it, is there reason to think that it's important? You know, I would say, so AMF does a variety of things. They look for proof that the bed nets were delivered, often with pictures. They look for post-distribution, they look for pre-distribution surveys of a certain thoroughness, checking who needs a net, which actually is I think AMF does that more thoroughly than a lot of other distributions, and that can reduce wastage. And they also look for post-distribution follow-ups to make sure people got their nets and to come in later and see if people are still using them and if they're still in good condition. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to compare this to other bed net organizations because if you don't measure it, we don't know what the situation is. So I think it's somewhat of a matter of judgment. I mean, if you know, if you'd rather write a check to Nothing But Nets and hope for the best, there's an argument for doing that, that there's not a tremendous difference here. That said, with AMF being as funding constrained as it is, you know, there was a time when we were kind of saying, AMF is having trouble getting money out the door. Our recommendations are moving a lot of money. Let's look for the next BedNet organization, even if they're not as strong on the monitoring. But we've dropped that for now because I don't see any reason to do that at this point. You know, AMF has plenty of need for more money. And so, you know, I think it's I think it kind of dominates the other options. But again, it is a matter of a judgment call. I mean, those distribution and monitoring costs are a small fraction of the costs. So it's not, I don't think you would get a big boost to your cost effectiveness by cutting back on them. You would just get, like, even less information than we have about how it's going.
Do you know offhand roughly, like, what percentage of their costs they are?
It's, I think it's under 10%.
Okay.
Yep.
This is, I guess, maybe more of a question for, like, open plan people, but, like, what is kind of the cost-benefit versus, say, funding initiative to, say, get a vaccine?
Sure. So what is the cost benefit of initiatives like, you know, funding development of new vaccines versus, you know, versus the stuff we do, which is very straightforward and linear. So a general theme of GiveWell is that GiveWell is a product in some sense for people who want to give, people who want to do as much good as possible, but also who don't kind of have a lot of time to decide and would like to give based on verifiable information that is kind of, you know, straightforward to explain and straightforward to demonstrate that the claims we're making are reasonable. And so GiveWell, you know, very explicitly and very deliberately has a bias toward things that are linear in this way, things that you can look at where your dollar goes, what it's paying for, you can prove it, you can, you know, estimate how much good you're doing per dollar. And I have to say, all this stuff, I mean, if anyone has a picture that our top charities are kind of ironclad cases, they're not at all. There's a lot, even when we go have this massive bias toward measurability, there's still a lot of problems and a lot of things we don't know and a huge amount of guesswork we have to do. And when we estimate those costs per life saved, you know, we publish our spreadsheet with all the different numbers you have to guess at to get to that number. And anyone who's ever downloaded that thing knows there's, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty here and those numbers can come out a lot of different ways. So I don't want to overstate the case, but we do look for the charities that look like they have the best case for this kind of linear, demonstrable, verifiable impact. What happens when you drop that requirement and you just say, I want to do the most good possible, you know, according to like me and according to my best guesses, even if there's much more debatable and unknowable things here. And I think that is the mission of the Open Philanthropy Project, like you said, which is the next session. I will say that a couple things happen that I think are worth knowing. One thing that happens is that the further you go down that road, the more your opinions and your views, I think, I predict, are going to diverge from the rest of the world. So, you know, when I talk about Open Phil, when I talk about the top charities, I think a lot of people are listening and saying, yeah, that sounds good. Those sound like they're helping people a lot, but is that really the best thing you could do? But when I talk about Open Phil, I think a lot of people are going to hear things and think, I guess that could be the best thing you could do, but that sounds totally crazy to me. And actually sounds horrible. And so, you know, that I think is that's the spectrum. And we kind of, we're kind of more interested in the two ends of it than in the middle. We're kind of more interested in trying to do the most verifiable things that we can pitch to anyone that anyone can believe in, or just trying to do the most good possible, even if it looks like really wacky to people who are not up on the issues. Then in that middle ground so far, and maybe later we'll decide there's a case for the middle ground. But I think that is one thing that happens as you go in that direction. And so, you know, if we were to look at vaccine research, we'd all just be massively guessing at the odds of getting a new vaccine and about what the scientific prospects are and whether this makes sense. And, you know, the more vaccine looks like it's easy to make and definitely can be done, the more it's already going to be funded. And the more things we find that are like, oh, we can make a vaccine for this, maybe, it's going to be a big maybe, and it's going to be a huge judgment call. That's one thing that happens. Another thing that happens is that, you know, so far, my take is that the top charities look pretty good compared to anything. And so, you know, having spent several years thinking about how to be the most ambitious possible and look all over the place, we've looked at all kinds of things, from political advocacy to scientific research to global catastrophic risk prevention. Are there other options that I could make a case are better? Absolutely. Are there other options that according to certain worldviews and certain biases and certain philosophical presuppositions are a zillion times better? Yes, there are. But are there, you know, are there interventions that I think are clearly better than our top charities? Not so far. And we've spent a while looking for them. So I think that is, you know, that is another thing. And so when I give personally, I give to top charities. And I think it would be even more true. You know, I think with me, it's kind of a strange case because the Open Phil project, I mean, we kind of generally tend to fund what we recommend. And so I partly give to the top charities because they're the thing that isn't already funded. But it's also, you know, if I had a different job and I didn't think about this stuff as much, I would especially want to give there because I think it is an easier made case. And I don't think you miss out on like a clear, obvious, massive win by sticking with this measurable stuff. I think when you're working on the developing world and you're helping people with such low incomes who have such, you know, basic needs, there really are, it's you know, in my opinion, kind of very unfortunate and says something negative about the world, but there really are some really basic needs that people have and some ways in which money can help very straightforwardly that I think are very good and not really easy to beat by looking elsewhere. Yep.
How many NGOs
Yep, how many NGOs do we evaluate each year to join the list of most recommended? So this has changed a lot over time. When we started GiveWell, we invited, you know, I think a few hundred charities to apply for grants, and it was kind of every reasonably large charity we could find that worked in relevant ways. And we kind of narrowed the field from there. And in 2009, and I think in 2011, we did these big sweeps where we looked at a lot of charities' websites, and we had an early filter that we were kind of looking for anyone who was publishing either suggestive things on their website that showed they might be evidence-backed, or someone who's working on an intervention with a good independent literature behind it. But having done that several times, We do feel we've hit diminishing returns. And I'll get to this a bit when I kind of get into the mid-session talk on future top charities. But we sort of feel like at this point, we've defined the criteria for top charities. We have learned that usually when there's really strong evidence behind an intervention, that evidence is academic literature. It is out in public. It is known. It is findable without going to the charity. I think when we started, we imagined that a lot of charities had like great evidence buried in a file drawer somewhere that they would give us if we asked them, but we don't really believe that anymore. And so, you know, now the process looks different, and now the process is more about knowing there's a certain number of interventions that have the evidence and keeping a really strong eye on the charities that focus on those interventions. And checking in with them to see where they are and whether they'd be interested in our process. And so we often look at like 3 or 4 charities a year, and we look at them really deeply, and we really try to dig and understand everything that's going on. And that feels like a more realistic way to find charities with these qualities. So most charities I can, you know, I can look at in 10 minutes and say, this is an interesting program, but it is not one that is supported by academic literature in the same way that our top charities are, or it is not one that is going to be as cheap as bed nets and you're not going to get as good value for money in terms of helping people. And so that is, you know, that is the way our process is now. We've got the criteria pretty, you know, pretty squarely defined, and that means the pool of plausible contenders is limited. Yep.
I think people are often confused by too many choices in a lot of different fields. There's a lot of studies that have been done on this. But are you concerned that maybe by limiting the number of choices, maybe not having enough of a diversified, you know, option to invest, that you may be kind of refusing some people who would otherwise invest in some other choices?
Sure. Are we concerned that we're offering too few choices to people and therefore discouraging giving? I mean, I think it's definitely a concern one could have about our work, or it's more, I think I might describe it less as a concern about our work and more as an opportunity for someone else. I think this is kind of a marketing decision and kind of an audience and niche decision, where our view is that the people we're trying to help are the people we're ultimately trying to help are, you know, sort of people who are receiving bed nets and deworming medication, but the kind of customers of our product or the clients are people who are saying, I want to give some money and I want to do as much good as possible. And that is just a very different mentality to be in than I think a lot of other donors who might say, I already know what charity I want to give to. Can you tell me if it's legit? That's not our mission. That is, you know, there's other groups that do that. There's other people who say, I want to give to this cause. I want it to be microlending. I want it to be in Ecuador. You know, do you have a charity for me? That is also not our audience and also not our product. And, you know, I've seen some attempts to kind of, you know, do that. So I would say it's more just a decision about where to focus. We focus on an audience that is similar in relevant respects to kind of us and what we wanted when we built this product. And so, you know, as kind of a member of that audience or a hypothetical member, I would just rather someone really nail what the best opportunities are, and I'd like to give there. And I think different products could serve different people. And, you know, I think it's great that people have efforts to do them, but it's just not the strategy we've chosen.
Mm-hmm. I read every once in a while about area mosquito control strategies that people are coming up with. Like, there's the thing in Brazil where they irradiated a bunch of male mosquitoes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys evaluate that? Is there a sense that that's coming up in cost effectiveness against bed nets as a strategy for malaria reduction, or is it still a long way off?
Sure. How do we feel about area control, like different ways of controlling mosquito populations? And are those competitive with bed nets? Will they be? There's a lot of different things under this heading. So indoor residual spraying has been around for a long time, and that's where you spray insecticide inside houses and you hope that kills a bunch of mosquitoes. That's something that I just believe is a lot smaller part of the malaria control picture than bed nets, and we don't know charities that focus on it, and we don't think we'd be able to get the same volume of like donations moved to it. You know, it is something we've thought about from time to time, but there's no charity doing it. We don't think it's like better than bed nets, though it often is a good part of a malaria control strategy. There are some strategies that have been used, I think, very effectively in different settings. So I think in America, getting rid of malaria here, where it used to be a big problem and is now not in America at all, there used to be a lot of swamp draining. And so there's a lot of things like that, swamp draining and, you know, fish that eat mosquitoes. I've heard something about that. And, you know, there's a lot of methods that have historically been used, I think, more in areas that we're trying to get from low levels of malaria to zero, rather than these very endemic areas. So my, you know, it's not something we've ever done a formal report on. We did have a lengthy conversation with a malaria control expert that we never got to publish the notes from. But our impression is that, you know, bed nets are the kind of, they're the thing you can do without infrastructure at great scale across a large distance, get good effectiveness, and we haven't seen any real competitor to them in terms of a charity. Now, what you might be talking about is more future, future control efforts, and that could include things like, you know, there's been a lot of headlines about genetically modified mosquitoes that might be malaria resistant, or that might just be like reproductively non-viable. That is the kind of thing that like could conceivably be a fit for open fill, but that is not that, you know, we're not going to say, hey, our top charity this year is taking a bet on the possibility that there could be genetically modified mosquitoes 10 years from now and you should support the, you know, that's kind of where we've decided not to be as GiveWell. Yep.
So as a donor, your top recommended charity is AMF, and you know, I really appreciate the important work you do, but I've given in the past mostly to AMF, but I tend to like give directly more lately because I just feel like in the case of AMF and people who are being saved, like, this sounds horrible, but like they were going to die. And I feel like that's not as bad, like as someone who's trying to do good in the world, I feel like that's not as bad an outcome as somebody living in poverty. So I wonder like how you weigh that. Basically, I'm saying, how would you convince someone like me to donate to AMF over GiveDirectly?
Sure. How should we compare AMF to GiveDirectly when AMF is largely preventing deaths and GiveDirectly maybe improving quality of life? So a few comments along these lines. I mean, one, I think this is a tough question, and it's not one that I would expect everyone to agree on. And, you know, so everyone knows, the way we do our cost-effectiveness estimates is we set up a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet has a bunch of places to put in numbers that can be debated. One of the numbers that can be debated, and actually this year's edition of the spreadsheet will highlight this more, is how you want to value averting a death, especially averting an infant death, because I think people have very different intuitions. You know, is it as bad for someone to die at age 18 as it is at age 3 or age 3 months? People have different intuitions about those things. And so you can put, you know, how do you want to value averting a death versus improving a year of someone's life? And there are multipliers that really it's just using intuition. It's like, would you rather double someone's income for a year or give them an extra year of life? Then what we do is all the staff members put in all their best guesses. We have a lot of debates and discussions about them. And then out of that big spreadsheet comes a number. So when I put in all my numbers, I get, you know, a result that AMF is like 5 times as good as GiveDirectly or whatever it is. And then we take all the staff inputs, and these days we'll have like 10 of them or something, and we'll list them all, and then we'll take the median. So that's our official cost effectiveness estimate. If you have different values, there's different ways to handle this. One, you could download the spreadsheet yourself and put them in there. You could, you know, copy another staff member's inputs because some of the inputs are a little bit esoteric, though we try to explain them in the spreadsheet. I think we could probably be doing it better. You know, another thing you can do is you can just go with your gut and you can say, hey, I believe I'm probably not going to value averting deaths as much as improving quality of life, so I want a quality of life charity. The final thing I'll say is that GiveDirectly is a quality of life charity in that sense, but so are SCI and Deworm the World. Deworming is also, you know, the benefits of deworming are just basically not at all coming from saving lives. The parasitic infections are fatal so rarely, and they're not the kind of thing that are, you know, affecting our calculations. So that's a quality of life thing too. That's basically an income boost, just like GiveDirectly, is the benefit that we're aware of. And so it's kind of how do you trade off the kind of uncertain future income boost versus the certain short-term, maybe smaller income boost. And then, you know, AMF is good to keep in mind. AMF is not just a death averter. So AMF reduces cases of malaria, and malaria can be debilitating. It can cause permanent damage. It can stress out the health system. It can have developmental effects, just like parasitic infections can. It can weaken people. It is associated with anemia in pregnant mothers and infants. So I think you get a pretty solid quality of life boost with AMF, but if you are counting the deaths averted as zero, you probably like deworming better because it's cheaper for the same kind of boost. So that's kind of the answer there. I'm going to go into the second phase of talking about future top charities, and then I'm going to take more questions, but I'm happy to take questions on any topic, so it won't just be limited to that. But, you know, one of the big questions that has come up over the years for GiveWell is, you know, we kind of have the same top charities every year, or some approximation of that. And I think, on one hand, this isn't necessarily a problem. I mean, our goal is not to be exciting and fun and have a new, you know, top charity every year just for the fun of it. But on the other hand, it does make you wonder, you know, can we find more good giving options and what can we do? And I think one of the things we've learned over the last few years is that the current method is probably not going to work. We feel like we probably are aware of all the serious contenders to meet our criteria, and we've gone back to many of them several times. And this year, we kind of tried to start doing another round of this, of going looking for the contenders and going to them and asking if they wanted to participate. And it was like we were looking at the same organizations, getting the same, you know, lack of interest in being a recommended charity, which surprised us because the advantages of being a recommended charity are much higher than they used to be. I mean, at this point, if you're a GiveWell recommended charity, you are probably going to raise all the money you can, all the money you can spend, unless that money is like getting above $5 or $10 million a year, and even then you might raise it all. AMF got something like $40 million, so and that those numbers are going up. So it seems like the incentives are there to participate in our process. And so I think my best guess is that charities that don't participate in our process probably, in many cases, do not have the data we're looking for, cannot demonstrate the things that we're asking for, or if they can, they, you know, probably like very strongly don't need more money or something. And so, you know, that approach just looks less promising to us than it did. And the question is, what else can we do? And I think one interesting fact is that our top charities, none of them are super old. So I think SCI is the one that's been around the longest, or maybe AMF, but AMF was very small compared to what it is now until we started recommending it. And so, you know, AMF was like, I think, under $1 million a year organization at the time we recommended it. Again, you know, we attributed $40 million of revenue to it last year from our recommendations. SCI has been around since like maybe a year before we started. GiveDirectly was founded, you know, several years after GiveWell started. And so these are, you know, and you were in the world also. And so these are relatively new organizations. And the question is, could there be future top charities? And can we make them more likely to come into existence by making recommendations and grants today? And so the work we do on this, we refer to as GiveWell Experimental. And it's a little bit of a hybrid or a middle ground between GiveWell and Open Philanthropy. The work is done by GiveWell staff. And I don't really work on GiveWell, so I basically work on Open Philanthropy. And so this is work that I'm like a little bit less intimately familiar with. But it's GiveWell staff trying to figure out which charities and which interventions and which pathways could lead to a future charity that meets all the GiveWell criteria. But methodologically, and in terms of the funder we work with, it's more like Open Phil in that we're willing to take long-term bets, high-risk bets, based on, you know, questions like, do we believe in the leadership here, which is also a factor for top charities. But and then we generally make recommendations to Good Ventures, which is a major donor that we work with. And Good Ventures, you know, has been funding things that we think can turn into future top charities. And these come in different shapes and sizes. So I'll give a few examples of this. You know, one grant recommendation we've made recently is to a group called R4D that is trying to improve access and execution of pneumonia treatment. They believe that pneumonia is neglected relative to kind of the quote-unquote big three diseases, which is HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. They're starting in Tanzania. They're going to try and increase coverage of antibiotics, improve health worker practices, improve distribution, get more accurate diagnosis. This is obviously a more complicated thing with more moving parts than distributing bed nets. And it could be very hard to evaluate, which is a worry of ours. But we do think there's at least a possibility that this will work, that we'll be able to see it worked, that they'll improve pneumonia access, save lives for a, you know, value for money somewhere in the range of AMF, and that would be great. And then it may scale up to the point where we're able to see the past and say this worked, and we can get more of it, and they're a top charity. So that's one example would be, you know, a group that is trying to scale up and trying to prove themselves and could directly become a top charity. And similarly, you know, we recommended a grant to New Incentives, which does conditional cash transfers, which is a program that we think is very promising. We just don't know any charities operating at scale that do it. And so we're funding this kind of early stage charity that gives out cash transfers in exchange for people proving things like their child going to school or getting certain vaccinations, and you get kind of a cost effectiveness boost there. So those are some things we're doing. We've also, you know, we're also interested in supporting work that leads not just to new top charities, but to new priority interventions. So one of the big filters, one of the big ways we narrow things down, is we only want to look at charities that are working on proven programs. So if we can fund more programs to become proven, then that helps too. And so along those lines, you know, there's this group ID Insight that does, they do decision-focused rigorous evaluations for decision makers. So it's more, there are a lot of groups doing randomized controlled trials, doing studies of aid programs, but a lot of them are academic. And a lot of them have academic incentives. They try to work on, you know, interesting questions in an academic way. And that is different from looking for, you know, really focusing on helping nonprofits and policymakers and funders make decisions. And so ID Insight is kind of a unique group that works on evaluations that are often not intellectually interesting in the same way as academia, but really valuable to decision makers. And we recommended general support to them. So not even a particular project, just expanding their operations, making them able to take more projects and maybe produce more proof of things that work. And then a final thing we've done is there's this No Lean Season program, which is done by Evidence Action, the same group that does deworming. And it's this interesting program where basically you provide financial incentives for people to migrate from rural to urban areas during kind of a tough season. And there's evidence from randomized controlled trial that when you do this program, people will still migrate a year later, even without the financial incentives. And so that's kind of an income booster and an information booster. And that's something where there has been a randomized controlled trial, and we're funding more of a pilot scale up and hoping to get them to the point where they can be a top charity. So that's, you know, that's kind of what things look like. And we feel like this stuff is, it's a little hard to say when it will bear fruit or if it'll ever bear fruit. Whether these things will ever turn into top charities, but it's probably our best guess path at how to get more. So with that, for another 5 minutes or so, I'll take questions on anything about GiveWell, and then we'll take a break and talk about OpenPhil. Yep.
Going back to a question earlier, so like gene drives are new experiment. It's new experimental technology that's only been demonstrated in, you know, a laboratory. But there are these OxyTech transgenic mosquitoes that have been demonstrated in the field in a few countries. And I was wondering if that is something that GiveWell has looked at or plans to look at, either GiveWell or OpenPhil.
Yeah, has GiveWell looked at OxyTech mosquitoes, which is a more mature form of genetically modified mosquito? I think OxyTech mosquitoes are not a fit for GiveWell. For similar reason to gene drives, it's not just about the tech not being there yet. It's also about all of the policy, you know, political questions about releasing genetically modified mosquitoes into the environment. I think that is often a big question about OxyTech. I also think it's, you know, I'm not super familiar with the evidence, but I don't think it would be yet at the same level as what our top charities are. I think this general area is a potential area of interest for OpenPhil, but you know, not something that we've done a lot with yet. But it is, you know, something we pay attention to for sure. Yep.
Just kind of on the topic of new top charities, but more generally, could you summarize or give your impression of how the cost effectiveness has changed in general over time and any emergency you might have over where that's going?
Sure. How has cost effectiveness changed in general over time? Things like our, you know, our estimate of how much it costs to save a life. How has that changed? I think in our early years we were way too optimistic in this. Well, I mean, it's weird to call it optimistic. I mean, in some sense, you know, the cheaper it is to save a life, the worse state the world is in some way. But you know, in our early years we had lower estimates. We thought it was cheaper to do good, and I think, you know, at some point we kind of got deep enough into the issues that we discovered a lot of things we hadn't been thinking about and a lot of concerns that hadn't been on our radar. And since then, I feel like for the last few years, our cost effectiveness has kind of gone up and down, but not in a super systematic direction. I expect that 10 years from now, I expect that cost effectiveness of top charities will be worse. Because there are, you know, the world's getting richer. I think the amount of aid is going up. I think the bed net gap may end up getting closed at some point completely. Deworming is, you know, a pretty cheap intervention, and I won't be surprised if governments are funding the whole world to get dewormed 10 years from now. And, you know, it's a newer intervention, so it hasn't been in the core government wheelhouse, but it could be. And so I would expect, you know, and there's other things. I mean, there's new technologies that can help control both parasites and malaria. And, you know, Africa is growing economically, and that helps too. So I expect some of these top opportunities to not be in existence anymore in 10 years, and I expect those cost effectiveness estimates to be more in the range of GiveDirectly. I think GiveDirectly is a pretty good lower bound in terms of, I think it will be true for a very long time that you could spend a very large amount of money if you want, giving money directly to very low-income people. And if you're systematically going after the lowest-income people in the world, then even as the world gets richer, that opportunity is still going to look pretty much the same, because there's a big pool of people you can help, and you know, you keep targeting those people, and there's a lot of them. So that's where I think things are going. Yeah?
Are you able to break down your cost per life save for AMF into a few key inputs? And maybe contrast that with how another organization might price out a cost per life saved.
Sure. Contrast, you know, our cost effectiveness calculation with maybe a more typical thing you might have heard. So, I mean, I think the way I would do this is, so bed nets cost about $5. And bed nets have some sort of relationship to preventing malaria and saving lives. And so a number, well, actually, I think they're a lot less than $5 now, but they kind of were last time I was engaging with this particular debate. I think there might be more like three. Let's say five. So, you know, a thing you will hear sometimes is send a net, save a life. I think that's the slogan of one of these charities. And, you know, I think you'll hear this kind of tenuous, like, well, you can save a life for $5. Which sort of implicitly means for $5 you can buy a bed net, and bed nets do save lives. Our calculation is, you know, a little bit more, well, is very different from that. And so, you know, the estimate is that, you know, you start with the Cochrane review of the 20-something randomized controlled trials of bed nets, of which I think five were looking directly at mortality. And the pooled analysis of just kind of putting together a lot of different studies and combining them into one kind of virtual study has an effect, and I may get this wrong, but it's something like one infant death averted for every 250 infants covered with a net for a year. So it's like person years of protection would be the metric. And so that's, you know, obviously that's where a lot of the difference comes from, because it's not like everyone who has a bed net would have died if they didn't have the bed net that year. That's more like a 1 in 250 thing. Then the bed nets are not all going to infants. It's universal coverage, which is how these things are always done, because you kill more mosquitoes that way. And because I think it's easier to get people to use the nets that way, and because there are people, everyone suffers from malaria. It's just the deaths tend to be in under fives, though we're not sure about that either. But, so you get, you know, you get, let's say 20% of the population, I think, is in that under five range. And then, see, so you know, you've got 1 in 250, and then maybe it's more like 1 in 1250 person years of protection of all ages is a life saved. But then you get, you know, average of about 2 years of covering two people each with a net. So it's like 4 years of protection for the $5 that a net costs. So let's say it's, you know, $1 per person year of protection, and we just got to $1,200. And then we have to put in some adjustments for insecticide resistance. We've got to adjust, you know, the threat of insecticide resistance, for the threat of nets getting wasted, and for a bunch of other factors that I'm forgetting. I at least got within a factor of two or so, or three. So that's, you know, that's the difference between those estimates. Yep.
Okay, so it's Ryan. So, I have two short questions. The first one is whether your GiveWell experimental is it taking off, like it's going to be really big in 5 years, like open fill, or is it just like you're just dabbling in it? That's question one. Question two is I was wondering if you could provide a bit of clarification about why you think the charity that you mentioned, where you give people incentives to move to the city when they're having an off season is like likely to be a good one, because I didn't really follow what you were saying about people move anyway later or something like that.
Sure. Okay. So number one, is GiveWell Experimental going to become a huge thing, or is it dabbling? I think that's not, we're not sure yet, but so far it is dabbling. We don't have some kind of like business plan that says this is going to become a 40-person massive thing that with a huge budget. We're looking for opportunities as we find them, and if we find ourselves overwhelmed with good opportunities, we may have to staff up to handle more of them. But it's, you know, so far it's very incremental. Why do we think No Lean Season is a potential good program? Well, so the study on getting people to move to the city didn't just show they came back the next year. It also showed like actual positive impacts on their income. So it's, you know, by moving, people make more money. And a lot of these charities, really the case is about reducing poverty and improving wealth. So it's that. I think the idea that they came back the year later is just like a positive sign that this program was kind of adding some sort of value beyond just handing people money. It was giving people information in some sense that changed their behavior in a more stable way. So I'm now going to call a break. We're going to take about 10 minutes, and then I will talk about Open Philanthropy Projects. So thanks, everyone.